Kish Film, Toll Booth. Details at universityymca.org.
It's the Afternoon Magazine. I'm Jeff Bossert in for Craig Cohen. It's 1240. Hard cider may not yet rival beer in popularity, but sales of the fruit-based alcoholic drink have been increasing rapidly in the last few years. A variety of flavors and the use of fruits other than the traditional apple are helping to attract a new generation of hard cider drinkers. Vermont Public Radio's Nina Keck reports.
It's happy hour at Two Brothers Tavern in Middlebury, Vermont, a bar that boasts an impressive assortment of beer taps. But one is bright green and shaped like an apple.
I think pretty much everywhere you go, you see at least one cider on tap now.
Amanda Geiger of Binghamton, New York, began drinking hard cider a few years ago.
It's not all like sweet apple juice with a kick. It's more variety. You know, you've got your drier ones, you've got your sweeter ones, you've got your spiced ones. And I just think there's more room for everybody's taste in there.
Bartender Andy Buxton nods.
Oh, sales have probably doubled, tripled in the last 2-3 years. It used to be nothing. Nowadays, probably 30% of people who are coming in here are demanding cider, not just asking for it. Even our locals who are drinking Budweiser are starting to switch over to a little bit of cider.
Cider's popularity has evolved since the late 80s, a lot like the craft beer industry. But it's only in the last few years that cider's appeal has exploded nationwide, attracting marketing giants like Miller Coors and Anheuser-Busch. Andrea Ribeiro, a beverage analyst for Nielsen, says it helps that cider appeals to both men and women. It's gluten-free and seen as something new.
People born in the 80s and 90s, which we call millennials, they really want what's new. They're always looking for the next big thing.
Which right now happens to be hard cider in all sorts of new flavors and fruit variations. According to Symphony IRI Group, U.S. cider sales for the last 12 months were just shy of $90 million. Leading the pack is Woodchuck Cider, which was first bottled in 1991 in a two-car garage in tiny Proctorsville, Vermont. Today, Woodchuck's bottling plant employs 125 people and cranks out 70,000 cases of hard cider a week. Brett Williams bought the company in 2003 and says since then he's watched the U.S. cider market go from a 4 million case category to 7 million.
When I started with the company way back when, all we heard was no. People didn't know what hard cider was. Now, it's gone from fringe behavior to a very small movement, but it's becoming powerful. People are incredibly passionate about Woodchuck.
While Americans still don't drink nearly as much cider as folks in the United Kingdom, Williams thinks there's plenty of room for growth.
The whole cider category is only 0.2% of the beer market. In England and Ireland, it's 15-20%. So there is so much upward traction for the category, it's almost mind-numbing.
Industry analysts doubt the U.S. market for cider will ever be as large as the U.K.'s, but Ireland's C&C Group is more bullish. The company plans to buy Woodchuck for a whopping $305 million. For NPR News, I'm Nina Keck in Chittenden, Vermont.
When we listen to a new musical phrase, it's the parts of the brain that control musical movement, not areas involved in hearing that help us remember what we've heard. Keeping the notes in order is a little like getting your muscles to move at the right time. NPR's John Hamilton has more on the Beatles' surprising contribution to the brain to brain science.
You know those albums you've played so many times that every song seems etched into your brain?
Michelle, my bell, these are words that go together well, my Michelle.
For Joseph Rauschecker, it was albums by the Beatles.
They were kind of the hot band at the time, and I would listen to music while I was studying, and my mother would say, oh, don't do that, you can't concentrate.
Rauschecker ignored her, and he says the White Album, Revolver, and Rubber Soul seemed to become a part of his teenage brain.
And then years later, I would put on one of these old LPs, and then, you know, at the end of one track, you immediately start singing the next one, as if it was all stored in your brain as a continuous sort of story.
Rauschecker became a brain scientist and eventually came to Georgetown University. But he kept wondering what part of his brain knew the order of all those sequences of Beatles songs.
The funny thing is, if you ask me now what comes after Michelle or whatever, I wouldn't know. It's not explicit knowledge. But if you hear it, then you can immediately continue singing it.
So a couple of years ago, Rauschecker's lab did an experiment. They had volunteers bring in a favorite CD and lie in a brain scanner. Then the scientists watched what happened as the volunteers listened. Sure enough, there was distinctive brain activity after each track ended. But Rauschecker says the brain activity wasn't where he thought it would be.
You would think the brain part that is relevant for hearing would be the one that's mostly activated, but no, it was the motor areas. So that was quite surprising and puzzling.
Motor areas control muscles. So why had this part of the brain been hijacked to remember music? To find out, Rauschecker and a graduate student named Brandon Green did another experiment. They presented the results at the Society for Neuroscience meeting in New Orleans. Green says the goal of this experiment was to see precisely what was happening as the brain learned a new musical sequence. He says this time they put volunteers in a scanner and had them listen to atonal music generated by a computer.
So let's think like a measure in terms of a musical score, right? So the first measure is played, then you have a short pause. Then the first and the second measure is played. Then a short pause again. First, second, third, and so on. So what happens is by the time the entire sequence is played, the parts in the beginning have been repeated something like 30 times, whereas the parts at the end have repeated once or twice.
Green says brain scans showed that motor areas became active when people were hearing something new, but these motor areas were relatively quiet when people heard familiar notes.
We saw as you progress to a familiar sequence, those areas became less and less important, and those activations decreased.
Meanwhile, during these familiar sequences, activity increased in areas involved in hearing. Rauschecker says all this suggests that areas involved in hearing can remember small chunks of notes, but it takes the motor system to put these chunks in the right order. He says it makes sense that the motor system is responsible for this sequencing function.
Because that's what the motor system has to do when you do a dance sequence or you ski down the slope. You know, you have to program your muscles to all work in coordination and in particular sequence, especially when you learn something.
Rauschecker says he's also found evidence that the motor system can step in to help retrieve a chunk of forgotten musical notes. John Hamilton, NPR News.
Support for today's broadcast comes from the Prairie Ensemble, with their first season concert on Friday, November 16th at Faith United Methodist Church in Champaign. The program, America's Music, includes Harold Arlen's Blues in the Night and George Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue, with U of I Jazz faculty soloists Chip Stevens and Chip McNeil. Details at prairieensemble.org.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Thursday. It's the 8th of November, 2012. It was on this day, 1864, Abraham Lincoln was elected to his second term as President of the United States, an election held in the middle of a civil war. The Confederate Army had recently gotten so close to Washington that Lincoln himself was able to watch a battle standing on top of a parapet with field glasses. On the 30th of July that year, 4,000 Union soldiers were killed in a disastrous attempt to invade Petersburg, Virginia. Lincoln knew he was going to have to call for another draft. The army needed a 500,000 more soldiers. There was an enormous war debt. And at the end of August, Lincoln wrote a memo to his cabinet that said, "It seems exceedingly probable that this administration will not be reelected." The Democratic Party was running on a platform of ending the war. But then news arrived in early September that the Union Army had captured Atlanta and Mobile. And suddenly the Democratic Party looked like the party of surrender, while Union forces were winning the war. And Abraham Lincoln carried every state except New Jersey, Delaware, and Kentucky. It's the birthday of Dorothy Day, born in Brooklyn, 1897, one of the founders of the Catholic Worker Movement, workers who lived in voluntary poverty and spent their lives in service to others. Her autobiography, The Long Loneliness, came out in 1952. And it's the birthday of the woman who said, in a weak moment, I have written a book. Margaret Mitchell, born 1900. And the book, of course, was Gone with the Wind, one of the best-selling novels of all time. When she was 20, she fell off a horse. She got very badly injured, kept re-injuring herself. And a few years later, she had to quit her job as a newspaper reporter and stay in bed. And her husband brought her piles of books from the library to keep her entertained, and then one day came home with a Remington typewriter so she could write her own. She decided to write about what she knew, and so she wrote about Southern Belles and Civil War veterans. Kept the book a secret until an editor from Macmillan was in town looking around for manuscripts. And finally, though she said the book was lousy and she was ashamed of it, she brought him piles of manuscript about 5 feet high. It took a lot of cutting, but it was published in 1936, an immediate sensation in the midst of the Great Depression. A book that begins, Scarlett O'Hara was not beautiful, but men seldom realized it when caught by her charm. Here's a poem for today by Faith Sheeran, entitled Tara. I grew up watching Gone with the Wind, with my grandmothers rehearsing for my life as Scarlett or Melanie. On the bright steps of my southern childhood, I practiced pinching my cheeks, holding my breath, while someone else tied my corsets. I could make a dress out of curtains. I could deliver a baby while outside Atlanta burned. When the wagon took me home to Tara, I would save the plantation by murder or marriage, my hat tied beneath my chin in a cheerful bow. Like Melanie, I would forgive anything, befriend prostitutes, donate my wedding ring to the soldiers. Someone would kiss me in a field where cotton no longer bloomed. I would want whatever I could not have. I would die trying to have another child. My husband would never recover from loving me, my shape on that marble staircase, too restless for an afternoon nap. Tara, a poem by Faith Sheeran from Moving the Piano, published by Stephen F. Austin University Press and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac. Supported by the Poetry Foundation, you can turn your iPhone or Android into a virtual poetry library with the Poetry Foundation's poetry app. Available to everyone online at poetryfoundation.org. Produced by Kathy Roach and Nick Vedder. Be well, do good work.